Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
You're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady, and when I'm not on the air, my job is to eat and drink and connect people. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, restaurateurs, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. First off, today at the Green Market, we'll hang with King Fujanakong of Kuma Inn and fellow radio host Jimmy Carbone of Beer Sessions, and he's also the owner of Jimmy's Number 43 at the Green Market, talk Filipino pickles. And then in a few minutes, live in the studio, we'll welcome chef partner Francis Derby of Beer and Butchery Bar Cannibal and the French-Belgian Bistro Resto. He's got a pretty eclectic set of awesome places he's worked at, the likes of Atlas, WD50, Momofuku, Taylor, Gilt, Mugaritz. We catch him before he heads out west to open Cannibal LA. And we're going to learn about growing up on a duck farm, starting out at his uncle's restaurant when he was just 14, the closure of Atlas, the opening of W50, and Spain. You will want to stay to the end because to wind it down, we talk essential sommelier tools with Tina Mori of Protocol Wine Studio in San Diego. Let's go to the Green Market.
I'm at the Union Square Green Market with King Fujanakong and Jimmy Carbone. King owns two restaurants. One is Kuma Inn in the Lower East Side and Umi Nom in Brooklyn. That means drink in Filipino. And Jimmy Carbone is the bar owner of the beloved Jimmy's Number 43 in the East Village. Hey, guys.
Hey, how are you?
Very good.
And we just opened Tito King's at
yes.
Jimmy's 43.
That's why we are here, because
the Tito King's Kitchen.
These old friends, they met 10 years ago while doing some good old-fashioned nonprofit work.
Days of taste. Chefs go into the schools and talk to kids about flavors, and they make salads, and great experience.
10 years ago, and they're still friends. And tell me about this bar food that's happening.
Well, Jimmy's 43 is a great spot. I've been going there always for the beer, and now they have a full liquor license, so we can get bourbon there too, which is a plus.
Yay!
And the food we're doing, Jimmy loves Kuma Inn too, so we either meet up at Kuma Inn or Jimmy's. And then
it's one of the perks of being restaurant owners.
Yeah, and you know, we were like, well, you know, let's do something at Jimmy's 43.
Cool.
So I'm doing a kind of like a Filipino Thai bar food menu at Tito King's. So we're doing things like pork belly adobo tacos, lumpia, which are like mini spring rolls.
Yum.
We're doing, I have a dish called halo halo fries. And halo halo is usually a dessert dish, shaved ice dessert dish.
I'm from Taiwan, so we have our shaved ice too.
That's right. But this is a savory version. So I took fries. We have our own french fries. And then I did a ground pork and black bean sauce. Oh, there goes my bike. Ground pork, black bean sauce, some Thai chilies. And we kind of, and bonito flakes, and sprinkle that over the fries.
Mm.
So we're doing fun things like that. So
what makes a halo halo in this sense?
Oh, because halo halo literally means
mix mix.
That's right.
Right.
So ground pork, bonito flakes, kewpie mayonnaise, black beans, Thai chilies, and you kind of mix that over the fries and eat it and grab a nice cold beer.
You know what would get it to the next level? If there was some kind of taro action in there.
Taro, yes, yes.
That is a traditional halo halo topping.
Yep.
And boy, that would be delicious.
Yeah. I mean, the beans, we have the beans, which are halo halo, but yeah, taro.
The bonito flakes really make it.
And the bonito flakes.
Extra.
It's kind of like to me, it's like a poutine kind of dish.
Yeah.
An Asian poutine. Okay, right. leave it up to the white guy to translate that for us.
And it's Tito King's kitchen at Jameson 43.
Yes.
And the other backstory is because King and I have known each other a long time, but last fall, his recipe was in the New York Times in the dining section for best wings in New York.
Yum.
And what I liked about it was I wasn't really a wings guy.
Yeah.
What his approach is, it's more like chicken. So tell him how you make the adobo chicken.
So the adobo, the wings, the adobo is the Filipino adobo is a very traditional Filipino dish, basically a braise, soy sauce, vinegar, garlic, black peppercorns, bay leaves. We braise it for about 45 minutes. The chicken's really tender. We dry it out, and then on the pickup, when people order it, we deep fry it.
Mm.
So it's really crispy, crunchy on the outside, and then it falls right off the bone like a lollipop. When you take the bone out, you see nothing but bone.
Yum.
And it's not chewy, and it's delicious. And it has that vinegary and saltiness to it, and that's why I like to match it up with pickles. A lot of the dishes I make over there, the accompaniment with it are pickles.
Mm-hmm.
Pork belly has that fatty, rich flavor, so I like to kind of offset it with something nice and with acid and crunchy, so pickles. And Green Market is the perfect place to find...
For pickle inspiration.
That's right.
Pickles are so universal.
Yeah, I mean, almost every cuisine talks about pickles, and it's a good way of preserving vegetables. You know, you could freeze them and then pickle them, or freeze them and use them for another use, or you can just pickle them right off the...
You can freeze vegetables and then pickle them. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's because, especially now, like when zucchini's big at this time of the year, the prices are low. You know, you could buy a whole bunch and you could have zucchini a few months from now in the winter and have nice... you don't even have to pickle it. You could just freeze them and then use them again for another application.
Right, okay.
Sauté, grill.
Better if they're frozen in a very powerful freezer to kind of...
Yeah, I mean,
quickly,
you
right?
want to have a commercial freezer.
Okay, of course. That's like, right. You want to have a commercial freezer.
Yeah.
At home.
Yes.
Just hanging out with a spoon.
No, I mean, at home you could do it at home too. Like the key thing is you just want to. I mean, you're not going to have a cryovac machine at home, but you want something to bag these in and just get the air out.
Got it.
So they sell those things
that
are not too expensive. So you bag them up because that's the hard part with the refrigeration. If it's not airproof, you'll get that freezer burn and all that. But if you seal it airtight, throw it in your freezer, you'll be fine.
These zucchini that we're standing in front of right now are, like, glowing. They're beautiful. And we're at Race Farm, which is in Blairstown, New Jersey. So how are we picking the perfect zucchini?
Well, zucchini, almost like a lot of other vegetables, you don't want to find anything with any blemishes on them. But, I mean, these are great. These were just probably picked yesterday or today, brought over to the market. They feel nice and firm. They're good to go. I mean, they cut the flowers off.
Okay.
You know, the flowers you could use for another application.
Mm-hmm.
You could stuff them, do different things with them, cook them, put them in a salad.
So what makes your zucchini pickles fit in the story of Filipino and Thai, Southeast Asian kind of food?
Well, you know, in the Philippines and Thailand, there are a lot of grilled foods, grilled items.
Mm.
Pork's a big thing in those countries, rather than beef. So pork tends to be fatty, which is good. I mean, I like fat. That's good, you know. It's not good for you, but it tastes great. Seafood, again, like whole fish, you know, it's all those countries are by the ocean. The Philippines is made up of 7,000 islands, so you're going to bring in a lot of fish. And the best way to cook it is very simple. Either grill it, fry it, just a quick cooking method. So with those things, you know, to kind of offset the richness, it's nice to have some type of acidity, either through lemon, lime, calamansi, or vinegar. We use different types of vinegar, rice wine vinegar, coconut vinegar.
Mm-hmm. Coconut vinegar.
Uh-huh. Sugar cane vinegar. So we use those vinegars, throw in a little bit of sweetness in there, and you could use brown sugar, any type of palm sugar, some type of sweetness in there. Sometimes if you don't want to add that, you could even just add carrots to the pickling, and the carrots will add that sweetness on its own. We also add some garlic, some ginger. If you want a little heat, you could throw in some fresh chilies. You could throw in dry chilies. You know, and salt. You want salt in that process, too.
Right.
And yeah, that's it. You have your pickle. So the pickle, to me, a good pickle, you want something that has a little crunch to it, salty, sour, sweet. Kind of hitting all those notes in that pickle.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll kind of lift whatever dish you're eating, be it a whole grilled fish, some grilled pork belly, some crispy lumpia, you know, something fried. Pickles and fried stuff go well. Pickles and grilled stuff, it's like a match made in heaven.
I see, you know, pickled cucumbers, that's a more typical thing, and so it's nice to go just a little bit over here and get a similar looking veggie that has a completely different texture flavor profile.
Yeah, I mean, you could literally, I mean, pickle almost anything.
Anything.
You know, it's a great way to preserve things. And
what is a more typical typical pickling vegetables in the Philippines?
In the Philippines, we use carrots, green papaya, you know, nice firm gourds, squash, daikon radish, different types of radish. Those are usually typically what you'll find pickled. Bitter melon, you know, bitter melon.
Yeah.
We pickle that. So again, like nice firm vegetables that, you know, back in the day and everywhere, there was no refrigeration. So pickling was really one of the number one ways of preserving vegetables. You know, you have a whole crop of vegetables, you're not going to let it go to waste. What can we do? Pickle it.
King, is there a word for pickles?
In the Philippines, we call just basic pickles like achara.
Achara.
Achara. Uh-huh.
With a T or a D sound?
A T.
Achara.
No, achara with an R at the end.
Oh, achara.
Achara. Achara. Uh-huh.
Achara.
Achara, yes.
Where are you from?
I was born here in New York. My mom's from the Philippines, and my dad's from Thailand.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, King.
Thanks, Lady.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Lady.
You know.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. If you love what you hear, do connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm at Leyte Sue, that's LEITIHSU. We're at Heritage_radio, and you can hashtag talk to us at, or hashtag actually, WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW. With that, I'm so pleased to welcome people we like. Chef partner Francis, Chef Francis Derby of Cannibal and Resto. We'll catch him before he leaves us to open Cannibal in Los Angeles. Hey, Francis.
Hey, lady. How's it going?
Very good.
Very good. Yeah, we're off to LA soon.
Yeah.
Very excited about that.
So tell me, you're actually about to move in for the rest of your time here in New York with your business partner, Corey Lane.
My boss, really. dear friend, Corey Lane. We met back in, 8 years ago at Momofuku. I worked with Corey. I knew Corey before that just from going into Sambar a lot. And over the years, become great friends. And that's actually how I ended up at the Cannibal. I was out of restaurants and in private chefing for a little while, and the Cannibal was 3 blocks from my apartment, and they had Wi-Fi and a cool backyard, which they still have. And so I would hang out in the backyard there, and then realized that Corey had started working there, it started taking over operations, and it kind of just happened organically. They needed a hand with a catering gig one night, and so I did that, and then I kind of signed on as kind of extra help and consulting a little bit, and then Cannibal got really busy and continued to get busy, and they asked me if I'd stay on to be the chef there, and so I did. And then 6 months later, we opened up Cannibal Hell's Kitchen at Gotham Market. Mm-hmm. And then 6 months after that, I took over Resto as well, and now I oversee all the restaurants. And now we're off to L.A. We're going to do Cannibal Los Angeles. So
what? Everyone's going to L.A.
Yeah, everyone's going to L.A. I'm a New Yorker, so I'm going to miss home, I think, for a little while. But I think I'll get used to L.A.
Really?
I don't know. I've been out there. I've been out there a couple times over the last year or so, and it's really nice. And, I think I'm going to dig it.
What does nice mean?
Well. It's not smoking hot like it is right now in the city. Like, I can't even walk 2 blocks right now in this nasty heat that we're dealing with. I think the produce out there is one of the things that is gonna, you know, I'm guess we have great produce here, but it, you know, there's a short window of time. I think we went in February of last year, and the farmers market in Santa Monica was just like strawberries and winter squash and summer squash and artichoke. I'm like, this just doesn't even seem fair at this point. Like,
much bigger crayon box.
Yeah, a little bit.
So is this kind of like a lifestyle change for you too?
Moving to LA, I feel like is probably a little bit of a lifestyle change.
Which one came first, the restaurant or LA?
What? How's that?
In terms of, did you want to move to LA and then the restaurant made sense, or the restaurant came?
No, I mean, I've been working with these guys for, I've been the chef for 3 years now. Wherever Cannibal goes, I will be with it.
Wow, love your good attitude.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fun ride. I mean, there's I'm totally up for that.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of the cool thing about this job, that when I initially started cooking, one of the things that was cool about it to me at that time, I mean, I was young. I was 15 when I started I was a line cook when I was 15.
At your uncle's restaurant.
My uncle was the chef there. It's my family's restaurant, the Varneys, which my aunt married into. And Little Seafood Shack, it's still there. It's in Brookhaven.
I read its Yelp and TripAdvisor reviews.
And they're good, right?
The Yelp is, so you get the person that's like, I ordered these two things because I was trying to keep my bill down, and boy, everything sucked.
I don't know.
Yeah, but no.
If you want, like,
very good
steamers,
reviews,
steamers, fried fish sandwich, like, that's the joy. Like, that's where I grew up cooking. Like, that's where I started. I started washing dishes there when I was 14. My mom was like, you're getting a job. And I said, all right. And I think it took maybe half the day of my first day of employment to go, wow, this is awesome. Like,
really?
Yeah, it was easy. It was just rock and roll music on the radio. My uncle's cooking. And I don't know. There was something about being in that environment. I immediately took to it. And it was easy for me to like that.
So prepping and washing dishes.
Just
like hanging out.
Yeah, I would work as hard as I can to get the cleaning and stuff done so that my uncle would put a knife in my hand. And then if he put a knife in my hand, I would cut the vegetables for the soup, and I would go home with the soup all proud that he made and give it to my mom and be like, look, Mom, I cut the vegetables for the soup. Taste the soup. It's really good. Uncle Eddie made the soup, and I cut the vegetables. That was kind of a big thing for me. Like, that was huge. And then Sundays started to get busier. I only worked Sundays because I had that whole school thing. They hired another dishwasher and put me on as the grill cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I am. I'm like a 15-year-old grill cook. And I was like, this is it. Like, I could just do this and not have to even think about school anymore. I'm like, this is awesome. So then after that, I started working at another place called the Bellport, where Taylor Alonzo, who's like my mentor and one of my closest friends of life. And
what kind of place is the Bellport?
The Bellport is it's country American, mm-hmm. is what he'll call it. But I mean, he's got everything from classic French to Indian to Japanese. It's a little bit of everything. It really is what American food is. It's 25 years old now. It's always been kind of a hot spot in the town of Bellport, where I'm from, which for some reason is becoming a hot spot right now.
Yes.
And it's, you know, that's where I really got my chops. Like, that's where I learned how to work saute and make pastry and do all that stuff, because it was very, very technical. And from then I moved to the city. But I still work for Taylor sometimes. Like, I think if he's got a catering gig over the summer and he's swamped, he'll call me and I'll make it out there for a Sunday to get him through. It's a blast.
Wow, that's fantastic.
He actually offered to come and help me with Cochon this year. He's like, if you need help, I'll come and cook. I was like, it was really sweet.
So your first restaurant job in New York was no small thing.
No, not so much. It's funny. My first restaurant job when I moved here was in Jersey City, so I don't really count that. But it's how I got to where I. It's how I, ultimately how I got to where I am today. I mean, I started cooking, like I said, in Bellport, and I met this random guy who lived in Jersey City, but he had worked for David Waltuck, Sean Durrell, he'd work at Boulay, and all these great restaurants. He moved back. I moved to the city without any money, without any job. I just assumed that because I was a cook and knew how to cook that I'd find a job, but back then, you couldn't get a job in the city unless you'd really worked in the city. I mean, we all say that now, but like, It was really strict back then. There was a lot of really great cooks 15 years ago. And
fewer restaurants of like demanding people like yourself.
Yeah. I mean, and I wasn't like myself 15 years ago. I was an okay line cook at best. So I called this guy up and he had a job for me in Jersey City. So I was commuting from Astoria, Queens, all the way to Jersey City every day. And then, oddly enough, it was 9/11 that stopped that commute, and I had to find another job because the trains it turned my 2-hour commute into like a 3 or 4 hour commute. Mm-hmm. And so then I started working at Atlas. But the funny part is I had already been staging at Atlas with Paul Libra because the chef at the place in Jersey City, which is still there, it's called the Iron Monkey, introduced me to Paul. And I started staging there and working on my days off with Paul. And that's the first time I saw that level food. And I knew that's what I wanted to do.
So side note is I'm thinking about your illustrious resume, and only some of the restaurants you've worked at have closed. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
A lot of the really old school ones in Jersey City and out in Long Island, they're still around.
Yeah.
So... Atlas closed abruptly.
Closed abruptly. There was a lot of things happened in the city at that time. You know, people were after that event, after, you know, 9/11, that there was restaurants closing all over the place. Like, mm-hmm. People stopped spending money. It got really nasty for a while.
So that was one
of them.
You know, when you...
Well, I had actually already put in my notice. I had had my last day already, and then I got a call from one of my closest friends at the time, and still to this day, Sam Mason, who I met at Atlas, and he said, I just got to the restaurant and all the doors are locked and we're closed. I was like, okay, well, I'll come pick you up and we'll go have a beer. It's basically how that went. But I had already lined up working that summer at the Bellboard again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is funny, but... You know, my plan was to get back into the city. You know, this is 14 years ago. My plan was to get back into the city and work at a Boulet or a Danielle or something like that. And Sam had already signed on as pastry chef for Wiley Dufresne's new restaurant and told me basically I was going to work there. He's like, no, you just come work for Wiley. That's what you want to do. I had never even heard of Wiley or met him. And wasn't really even sure if I was going to get the job. And the funny part was the way I think the reason I got the job is because I went and I met Wiley at the site of WD before it was, you know, while it was all dirt floors and still very much under construction. Mm-hmm. And Sam introduced us, and, you know, everybody had come to Wiley at that point, I guess, and asked for sous chef position, or they want to be the poissonnier, they want to be the meat roast. And then my favorite, absolute favorite station in any kitchen is Garmage. I love the work of Garmage. I think there's something about that to me.
You're a delicate, sensitive guy.
Yeah, something like that. So I asked him for that position. He was actually taken back. He said, oh my God. He's like, no one's asked me for that position yet. He's like, that's crazy. And then I just hung around, and I was part of the team that was hanging out in Wiley's kitchen when at his home.
Because that's usually what people start off as, right?
Yeah.
That's okay. Just putting that out there salads, it's like the pretty stuff, it's all the cold stuff.
The terrine work and the cold, dainty stuff.
Yeah.
It's the delicate stuff.
Wow, but that's such a fun station. WD-50, was it like what it was, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it evolved very much over the years, but I mean, I'd say that station, that's a tough station in any great kitchen, you know? Later, after that, you know, that station evolved into, you know, having two and three people on the station, and got way more intricate with all the tasting menus. I think that that's where a lot of chefs will have a lot of fun, and that's a playground for a lot of chefs.
Right, and that's a where a lot of the most memorable dishes kind of happen.
I love it. That to me is, there's something special about that work.
So you opened WD50 as Garde Manger, and then you
worked
went
up
on
to Tournant, and then it was time to leave the mothership.
So Wiley Dufresne, what a legend.
Yeah.
What's something about him that maybe, you know, not everyone who hasn't worked so closely with him knows, you know?
I used to get a kick out of working with Wiley because we would be very physical with each other. And by that I mean, like, there would be the occasion, like, I'd be picking up a piece of fish and somebody would start pinching the back of my arm or something like that. I'm like, oh, stop it. I'm in the middle of a pickup kind of thing like that. Or the occasional, like, you know, it was kind of this cool brother, big brother, little brother kind of back and forth that we had. And I do remember one day probably going a little too far and him just giving me that look like, dude, if you ever pop me like that in the middle of service, I'm like, oops, sorry. it was fun to Wiley. It was always like a sport, you know, and that was kind of the fun part. Like, we had these, it wasn't just the cookie. Like, we'd have a lot of fun with, like, sliding stuff down the line, like kind of, it was, there's fun there. It was obviously serious cooking going on, but those 12 and 14 hour days didn't seem grueling. There was, you know, while we were prepping, there was music always, you know, and when we're in service, we're having a good time, and we're that to me is what, like, I want that in my kitchens, mm-hmm. you know, I understand I understand how important it is to have discipline in kitchens, and believing there's, you know, you have to have discipline, of course, but there's always, it's got to be fun. I mean,
what's your favorite music to cook to?
Steely Dan, easy. Yeah, I mean, that's a given. Everyone pretty much knows that. I mean, I'm a huge Steely Dan fan, but I just know that. I mean, we used to do it at Taylor with, like, if service started getting really rocky, or we started seeing the room fill up and we knew we were in for a good push, you just put on some Steely Dan and everything will be fine.
Wow.
Just because it's so smooth and so chill. But how can things possibly get out of control when that happens?
You went to Spain and you cooked at Mugaritz for 4 months.
I did. It was one of the most amazing experiences. Wiley had actually set that up with Andoni that, you know, I would go there and so lived above the restaurant for 4 months, not 4 years. That would have been nice. for 4 months, where I met a good friend of mine, Johnny Mack, who now is Rival Brothers Coffee in Philly. It's funny, the way that came about was that I became good friends with him because I don't speak any Spanish at all. So I went to, like, I don't even speak what people call kitchen Spanish. I'm just horrible at it.
Yeah. At all languages or just Spanish?
All languages. Cool. I speak, yeah, I barely speak English. no, so I got there and the whole car ride from the plane to the actual restaurant was just me trying to figure out what the person that had picked me up was saying, and it was very broken English and really, really nice, sweet person. I was like, wow, this is going to be a long 4 months. So I get there and they're like, you want to meet Jonathan. And I was like, okay, so I want to meet this guy, Jonathan. Hopefully he speaks English. And this guy comes out of the Corte de Frio, which is their cold prep room. And he's like, yo, what's up, bro? And I'm like, whoa, what's up? How you doing? I'm like, I'm Francis from New York. He's like, Philly, man, what's going on? He's like, welcome. Awesome. Let me show you around. I was like, oh, sweet. This is going to be so much easier than I hoped. And he actually, Johnny Mac became one of my closest friends. He actually, after Spain, moved to New York to open Gilt. We opened Gilt with Paul Liebrandt. He was part of that crew. Mm-hmm. He slept on my couch when we first got here. Like we became instantly pretty tight.
Yeah. You just only because he was your first English speaker.
Yeah, we just hit it off. We're just I don't know. We got along well. It was pretty good.
So Chef Andoni took you and John around.
So yeah. So basically, you know, Andoni would talk to me through Jonathan, which is kind of funny because the first day I'm there, Andoni comes up and he calls Jonathan over, and I don't know what to expect. I don't know what I'm getting into. I'm in Muguri's, in the middle of Spain, and at this incredible
big
Michelin
place,
star restaurant.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just trying to be on my best behavior and no joking around. and I'm standing there and I'm just observing service, and I'm in my, you know, regular civvies. They asked me to just come down. I don't have to suit up. I just want to check out service. So Andoni comes up to me and kind of looks at me. I've met Andoni a couple times. I know he's pretty, you know, he's a phenomenal chef. He's very intense. He's also really relaxed. So he comes up to me and he calls Jonathan over, and he starts reading me the riot act through Jonathan. He's given, you know, rule number one, blah, 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 rule number two, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know what he's saying because it's all in Spanish. But see, I'm like, oh, man, he is giving me the riot act. Like, I'm getting the, there's no smiling in my kitchen. There's no tardiness in my kitchen. That's what I'm expecting to hear.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, what's he saying? And then Johnny Mac's like, so this is what Andoni said. He said, anything you want while you're here, you got it. You want to eat at any restaurants here in Spain, please tell him and he'll make the reservation. You can work some days or you cannot work some days. If you need a lift, just let him know and he'll figure out a way to get you back into the town. I was like, oh, cool. Okay. Like, wow. All right. Not exactly what I was expecting. So, yeah, my time in Spain went really well. Andoni specifically took us out one night to this citeria in the way backwoods of you know, Basque country, and like down some dirt road, and it was pretty serious. It was me, Jonathan, and Andoni, and it was just towards the end of my trip, so I was like starting to pick up some Spanish a little bit.
The kitchen is very English speaking, right? Because there's folks coming in from all over the world.
Yeah, I'm not really.
Not really.
I mean,
okay.
Well, because he doesn't speak any English,
right?
So I don't think. I think it's important for him to understand what everyone's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone speaks Spanish.
Wow.
Basically.
Okay.
So
you went to this restaurant.
So we went to this restaurant, and it's just this unbelievable citeria in the background. And
what's it called?
I have no idea. I couldn't tell you.
Good job.
Thanks. It might not even have a name. It looked like somebody's house.
Okay.
It was pretty incredible. We had this amazing meal. We ate whole monkfish. We ate giant cuts of ribeye. We drank a ton of cider. And like halfway through the meal, I had enough cider in me. I just started speaking Spanish, which was kind of hilarious.
Really?
Yeah, just out of nowhere. And Anton looks at me. He's like, wait, are you speaking Spanish right now? I was like, yeah, I think I am. And I was saying it, and I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. That was the only time I was ever able to speak Spanish. So that happened. They both looked at me and they're like, are you speaking Spanish to us right now? I was like, yeah, I think I'm speaking Spanish right now. But I was just getting by. Like, it worked. They say if you spend, 3 months or 4 months in a place, you start to pick up the language. I feel like if I would have stayed for 6 months, I probably would have come home speaking Spanish. But I had to cut my trip short to get home and open Guilt.
Right.
Which was kind of awesome.
Guilt, high flying.
Yeah, we opened Guilt with some of the greatest cooks I've ever worked with, who all went on to do amazing things. Johnny Mac was one of them. Yeah, there's a lot of great cooks came out of that kitchen. After that, went and opened Taylor with Sam Mason.
You know, I went to Taylor. Like, that was my before any other molecular gastronomy-ish place, that was my first place that I'd ever been to.
Oh, really?
Yes, in my life.
That, I think, was the last time I really actually cooked like that. After that,
I still remember the foie gras
peanut butter foie gras with chocolate and peanuts.
Yeah. Right. And I think I was sort of doing the thing where, is it like the emperor has no clothes, or is this truly good? And like, how is this delicious? Is it delicious? Do I buy into this?
Yeah. I, you know, I like to think that everything we made was delicious, but I
was a new bear, yes. But yeah, that was very tasty. That was brilliant.
We were going for it. There's no doubt. I mean, yeah. We had a lot of fun cooking. I've always loved cooking with Sam. We have very similar ways we look at food. We've come up through the same, you know, come through the same kitchens to some extent. We have similar, you know, we work well together. I'll say that. I've always enjoyed cooking with Sam.
You have a really colorful background. You've got the more kind of everyday restaurants that you could really go in and get something, you know, hearty and something meaty. And then you've got like the molecular stuff. You have like a pretty wide skill set now.
Yeah, I do. It's funny because I don't really delve into the molecular stuff much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I missed a lot of stuff in those years because I was a lot of my younger years as a cook was that kind of food, and there's a lot of stuff classic stuff I didn't really know how to do. I didn't know how to make pâtés or even make, you know, a solid pasta dough. I can gel the East River if you needed me to, but I couldn't. But I could, you know, there was a lot of classic stuff I didn't know. It's Wiley actually bought me the Big Ducasse book when I left WD because he knew that was in my head. He's like, here, I got you this. I figured this was more appropriate than getting you something you already know about. So here's all the classic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I feel like the way I started pulling out of that was working at Sambar because there really wasn't, that was not the style of Sam. Sam was very straightforward. The food that Tin was doing before
Sambar
I started there.
Was so hit the spot for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for me too, like that was always one of my favorite
tasty
restaurants.
Tasty, umami-driven, but with some fine dining touches.
And just three ingredients on a plate. Like, that was it. So for me to wrap my head around that it took a while, but you know, eventually I started to see food that way and how approachable and simplicity and can really be interesting. It wasn't always, then it became not just about how far we can push food, what tricks can I do now? And I don't think that molecular gastronomy is like that. Not for the people that are good at it, I guess, if that makes any sense.
But you've really come full circle. You've gone from red sauce, clams, steamers kind of spot in Long Island to like WD-50 and Moomerits to like, you know, I think at Cannibal you've got like just charcuterie and stuff that's really whole that's done with a lot of precision.
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem admitting to anyone that when I started at Cannibal, I had never broken a whole animal. I had never made sausage.
Yeah.
I had made some pâtés. Like, my pâté work was okay.
Yeah.
And now it's what I do. I'm better known for making pâtés and sausage and breaking whole animals than I am anything at this point. And I have actually only been doing it for 2.5-3 years. It's kind of crazy.
Juan Cochon, you've come a long way. You've gone from being like a late bloomer in meats to like the king of pig.
It's something that was new to me. It's fresh to me. It was like I didn't have a choice. I had a sous chef working for me at the time who took care of all the sausage in the butchery. So I was like, oh, this is going to be easy. I have someone that does all that stuff. So even though I don't know it, I could still like navigate around a menu and plug and play, you know, come up with some ideas and here, and then that person got wounded in battle and was out for 2 months.
What kind of battle?
Working in the kitchen.
Oh, really? Like,
there was a bandsaw. But the
is that person okay?
That person's totally fine.
Gosh.
That person's totally
yikes.
Fine. The point being that on the day I started, the main person that did all the stuff I didn't know how to do was no longer able to do that stuff. So I remember the first night making sausage, and I'm making rabbit sausage, and I got it in the press, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing right now. And the sausage casing is busting all over the place, and I'm freaking out, and I'm sweating.
You
I'm
call
like,
it
oh
a
my God, I'm never going to be able to pull
sausage.
It. Yeah,
you're like,
right.
Hey guys, today our special on the menu.
Deconstructed, put some upside down ribs on it. But it became something that to me became something that, like, I don't know how to do this. And that's what's always driven me anyway. You know, it wasn't like I came from Long Island cooking seafood and cooking this kind of classic French to come here and do the same thing. I didn't go search out those. I saw what Paul Liebrandt was doing at Atlas. And I was like, oh my God, I've never seen that before. I have to do that. And then seeing that, you know, the stuff at Campbell, like, I was like, I don't know. I'm not versed enough in that. For me, my whole career has been about plugging in all the holes, like to make a one day, hopefully, a complete chef. You know, like, I never went to school, so I felt like I had a lot of things that I'd missed. So whole animal butchery and charcuterie is a huge thing that I didn't know anything about. Now I'm just starting to get to a point where I'm comfortable with that stuff.
So let's say you and your boss, Corey Lane, and all of, you know, the whole cannibal resto world were to, you know, get the opportunity to open another totally discreet other concept. What would be, like, your dream, you know, next thing that you explore?
My dream?
Yeah.
My personal dream restaurant at the time, and I don't think this is any secret to anyone, is that I love fish. I fancy myself a great fish cook, you know, I'm from Long Island. I grew up cooking fish. I'm going clamming, and, you know, I spent a lot of time at the beach as a kid. And, mm-hmm. Like, that's, fish is very dear to me and important to me, and I've always loved cooking fish. There's something, it's almost as delicate as the garmage work. Meat cooks are hard to find because a natural meat cook is, there's a feeling to it. You know, I know a couple great meat cooks. I've never thought of myself as a meat cook, though. I am the chef of three very meat focused restaurants, and I love that. And I think my approach to that is probably a little different than most people's because of my garmage and my...
Because of your delicate, sensitive side.
Sure.
Cool. So dream job, if you were not a chef.
Dream job, if I wasn't a chef, is crazy. I don't even know if you could call it a job. It's more just a dream. I would have loved to be in music to some extent, whether it was in a band or being a music teacher or being in production, anything that involved music. Music is pretty much is a very big part of my life. My father was a drummer in a band when he still is now. But, like, when I was growing up, I was watching my dad play in random bars, and my aunt introduced me to bands like Led Zeppelin and Frank Zappa and all that stuff when I was, like, you know, 8. And, like that's real to me. Like, that, music is a very big part of my life and always has been. I feel like, you know, it was always a dream, and it didn't seem like something I can eventually make a reality or make money of. So I had to get an actual trade, you know. So I chose the cooking thing.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Francis, yeah, for joining us. Lovely to finally get you into the studio.
It was awesome to be here.
With just a few minutes left to wind it down, after this quick commercial break, stay close because we'll talk the SOM kit, Sommelier Tools 101, The Essentials with Tina Mori.
Hi, I'm Harold McGee. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a nonprofit organization, which means they depend on the support of listeners like you and like me. The best way you can support this program and others like it is to visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org, as I have, and click the donate button to become a member today, as I have. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth on Heritage Radio Network. And today, to wind it down... We have Tina Morey, certified sommelier and partner in Protocol Wine Studio, a wine education space in San Diego. Hi, Tina.
Hi, lady. How are you?
Good. So I'm always astonished that, you know, whenever I go to anybody's house, people in their cabinet have all sorts of nicks and knacks and stuff that, like, when you go to Bed Bath & Beyond, they say you need this and that to open up a bottle of wine. what's actually like necessary?
Actually, wine key. I think those in the industry call it a wine key. Some people call it a wine opener. I think the leading one right now is called Pull Tap. It's, the best ones have a hinged lever, so really easy to get those tricky corks out. Another tool I think that comes in super handy, especially for those older bottles, is called an ASO. Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Yes, but, yeah, you know that.
But tell us more. It looks like kind of like a tweezer. It looks kind of like a closed pin that's always open, but with really, it's like the shape
that's
is...
That's an excellent description. I love that, yeah. And then the next one, and this is just born from experience, a Band-Aid. Seriously, a Band-Aid.
So tell us if you could describe something that's actually quite visual, how each of these latter two that are a little bit more advanced would be used. And an instance in which the bottle of wine calls for these two tools, that would be great.
So I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Could you describe the latter two and in what instances they would be used?
Yeah, actually. So the wine key is used just to open up every single bottle, obviously, except the screw caps. And the ASO is mostly used for those older bottles. Sometimes the corks disintegrate a little bit, and then you find yourself pulling out the cork, and it breaks. What do you do? So you drop in the ASO, much like you described earlier. You drop in the ASO on either side of the cork, that disintegrated cork, and it pulls it right up, lickety-split. Really easy.
You kind of squeeze it in. In either side.
You squeeze it in a bit, yeah, just kind of around, and it just drops right in within the bottle. So it makes it really easy, and some use it in restaurants all the time, wine bars, even at home, I use it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Those old bottles, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then number three?
And number three, like I said, a Band-Aid. You always need a Band-Aid.
Yeah, what is...
inevitably, you're going to cut your finger.
Oh, you mean a literal Band-Aid?
The wine key, people always cut their fingers.
Wow. So does your
sock... that sounds odd, but trust me.
Yes, those tiny little cuts that get all over my hands.
They do, yeah.
Where'd that come from? What is included in your SOM kit that you're offering up right now?
Yeah, so we just began a new product called SOM kit, like you said. It's basically, there are two iterations at the moment. We have a canvas model, and then we're working on right now a more industry-focused leather model. So what comes in the budding sommelier model, which is the canvas, is the pull top and the ASO and a Band-Aid. And, of course, in the industry-focused SOM kit, nothing comes in it because I think for everybody, when you get to the industry, you have your own stuff. You have your favorite ASO, you have your favorite pull tap, whether it's a colored pull tap or the beautiful, the wooden ones. That is very personal. So we're just creating the product to transport everything.
The pull tap is the thing that has like it looks like it's like the old school. you know, thing that you screw in to the cork and you pull it out, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And something that like that is just, you know, more delicate than your typical wine key.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the osso. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that they're like actually the same osso and wine key. I mean, pull tab are actually the same thing.
Yeah. So pull tab is a brand, and that's I guess what most sommeliers use. I've used it for years. So pull tab is the brand of wine key, and the osso is another brand, and that's where, like you described earlier, where the the two prong thing.
Okay, so they can all actually come in different shapes.
They do, yeah. The osso comes in a couple of different sizes depending upon the bottles, but the wine key also comes in different sizes too. But I think for most people, and what I use is a hinged model. It makes pulling out the cork very easy.
So what have you been learning as you're rolling out this product?
We're learning what people want to see with it. We're learning what people use out in the market. It's fun to see people who are just kind of taking wine classes, and they help out their friends in wine bars or in wineries. It's cool to see what they're putting in it. A lot of people put, obviously, a brush. A lot of women put brush in it, and it's more personal. I have people putting in a little folder with their notes, and I have people putting in, a lot of people use Bic lighters, and they use that, especially for older bottles, for drying out the sediment. So it all depends. I mean, people are really individualizing it, and Somkit, as I said, it's pretty much just a tool used to transport your individual sommelier tool.
Awesome. Where can we find you on social media?
Protocol Wine Studio. It's just like it's pronounced. And that is my website. Somkit, SOMMKIT.com has its own. On Protocol Wine on Twitter and Instagram as well. Facebook, same thing.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Tina.
Thanks so much, Letty. Appreciate it.
We're live to p.m. Eastern Wednesdays on Word of Mouth, heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Leyte. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell. And today's engineer, let's thank Liz Smith. Hi, Liz. Today's break music was provided by Mamarazzi. The show's theme song is provided by Jackie Gordon. Also, thank you so much for tuning in, listener. If you liked what you hear, tell your friends to subscribe to the show on iTunes, and feel free to get in touch with us at heritageradionetwork.org. Next up, we have a teaser clip of Danny Bowen of Mission Chinese Food talking the intersection of food and family on Eat Your Words, another fantastic show found right here on Heritage Radio Network.
You know, we weren't the most well-off family growing up, so we always ate at home. We didn't go out to restaurants that often.
Acclaimed chef Danny Bowen of Mission Chinese has fond memories of food and family.
And my mom cooked, you know, like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and yeah. I was just so fascinated. I always stand in the kitchen and cook with my mom, which is it was amazing. You know, it was like really cool. It was a good time that we always spend that time together, and I think that's what really inspired me to want to cook. And it was cool because for that, you know, hour that we ate every night, you know, the whole family was there, and my dad was there and he worked, so I got to see him and talk to him. So it was cool. I always thought that like cooking and bringing people together, being able to hang out with your friends or your family is really important. I think that was one of the major reasons that I wanted to cook. I didn't know that once I started cooking I would never see my family or friends because I'd be cooking all the time, but but you know, it's you see them when they come to the restaurant.
You're fostering friendship and family for other people,
right,
I guess.
Right.
Good times.
Yeah.
This was an excerpt of episode 100 of Eat Your Words, hosted by Kathy Irway. All episodes available on heritageradionetwork.org and iTunes. This piece was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm. Escape through the net. EscapeMaker.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.